From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, lame duck update. The GOP tries to create a new state education commission and weaken the Board of Education and incoming Democratic governor. Plus, how insurance companies could get climate change skeptics to start believing it's here.
The number of natural disasters has tripled since 1990. This isn't science data. This is data from Munich Re, a reinsurance company in Switzerland.
Attorney General Bill Schuette on his decades-long friendship with George Herbert Walker Bush, including time on the presidential campaign trail.
We're in the car and we're driving, doing this and that. And he looked at me and he goes, Schuette, nobody said it would be easy. And everybody was right.
And the 175th birthday of the USS Michigan.
It was revolutionary. It was the first all-metal, all-iron ship in the United States Navy.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Big changes in lame duck could be coming over who controls oversight of Michigan schools. Bills sponsored by term-limited GOP Representative Tim Kelly of Saginaw would create a new 13-member education commission. Ron French of Bridge Magazine is here with us. Ron, what kinds of things would this new education commission be empowered to do?
The commission would be empowered to look at how schools are judged. Is the most general way to say it, how schools are ranked, which schools are considered to be successful and which ones are failing. And perhaps most importantly, then they can look at what the consequences of that are. They can determine whether a succeeding school gets extra money or a failing school closes or a failing school gets extra funds to try to help it. And this is something that's always been under the purview of the State Board of Education, the Michigan Department of Education, and the governor. And no one had a concern about this sort of situation until Democrats won the election in 2018.
Okay. And because I have to say, isn't this why we have an elected State Board of Education?
Exactly. And the State Board of Education was evenly split 4-4 between Republicans and Democrats. And after the election, it's going to be 6-2 Democrats. So it's not lost on anyone. In fact, Tim Kelly's fairly open about the reasons he's doing it. He feels that the State Board of Education is not doing a good job, and he's trying to take power away from them.
Who would get to appoint the 13 members of this new commission?
That's the key, Cynthia. It's split up a number of ways, but the key is that of the 13 members, seven of them, so a majority of them, would be appointed by the governor. If this passes here in lame duck session, Governor Snyder would have the opportunity to appoint the majority of the commission before he leaves office. Those people serve a four-year term, which is exactly the same term as the incoming governor. So Governor-elect Whitmer would be locked out of this commission.
So there would be a majority. Who else? So he would appoint, what, seven members? That would give him the majority.
Yes, and the Speaker of the House, who is a Republican, and the Senate Majority Leader, who is a Republican, would each appoint one more. And then the state superintendent would fill four spots. In reality, that would mean that there would be nine spots that would be filled by Republican appointees.
Ron, describe how the effort to create this new education commission is, as you put it, tucked away into GOP-backed education reform efforts.
Sure. There were two bills that are totally unrelated that we noticed when we were looking through the bills that both created a commission, and by golly, they were both named exactly the same thing, and they both had the same number of commissioners, and both got created by Tim Kelly. The two bills, one creates an A to F ranking system for the schools. That's controversial, and that gets lots of publicity about whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. We can talk about that another day. And another bill would create exceptions to rules that say how many hours students have to be in a classroom setting. It's for schools that want to experiment more with internships and things like that. You could argue pluses and minuses about the bills, but both of them, and then go on to say, and we're creating a commission to oversee these things. Well, the thing is, once you create a commission like that, that has these broad education authority, future legislatures can just keep adding more and more responsibilities to that commission, which in effect takes power away from the State Board of Education.
Which is elected. Who is this board accountable to?
To be honest, no one. Once they're appointed, they're on their own. They do not answer to the governor. They do not answer to the State Board of Education. They do not answer to the Department of Education. They can make decisions on things and then tell the Department of Education to go ahead and do what they decided.
How far have Representative Tim Kelly's bills progressed so far in lame duck, Ron?
They are on the floor of the House. They are trying to round up votes for it, the Republicans are. Apparently it's going to be pretty tight, but it's still awaiting a vote in the House. If it passes there, it would go to the Senate.
What's Team Whitmer saying about this effort to tie her hands on education reform?
I believe she's trying to not make this as much of a political issue because, for one thing, the more she comes out against it, probably the more votes the Republicans would be able to get on it. But she has said that she is against anything that would tie her hands, basically, because education reform was one of her big issues, as it should be. Education is a big deal in Michigan. Our schools are sort of flailing. But they've been flailing for the past 8 years when Republicans have been in charge. And so it seems odd that at this moment they quickly create a commission to fix things.
Ron French, Bridge Magazine, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And more lame duck change could be coming, this to a ballot initiative approved by voters November 6. Proposal 3 was called Promote the Vote. It would establish automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, and no excuse absentee voting during the 40 days before an election, among other provisions. 2.7 million votes, that's way over 66%, were in favor of the proposal. But now Republican Senator Mike Kowal has introduced a series of bills during the lame duck session that would alter what voters approved. With us is Sharon Dolente. She's the voting rights strategist for ACLU Michigan. Sharon, how will Senator Kowal's bills change what voters approved in Proposal 3?
So there are a number of ways in which Proposal 3 would be undermined by the bills as they are right now. Number one, it would restrict the access to same-day registration. So Proposal 3 was very clear on the requirements of what someone needed to do to register on the same day as they received their ballot. That's appear in person and provide proof of residency. The bill as currently written provides extra requirements on voters. So it goes above and beyond in a way that is not permitted from what voters adopted in Proposal 3. Another instance is that it attempts, I guess one could call it, to implement an audit, which was another very important part of Proposal 3, a post-election audit. But it doesn't, by rushing it through in this very short lame duck session and not really having the time to think about what would be the best way to secure the integrity of our elections, it's not implementing a state-of-the-art, effective audit system that would really tell us that our votes are being counted properly. So those are two of the issues. Also, the bill does not at all address the fact that straight party voting has now been reconstituted in our Constitution, and the voters decided that they wanted that back and that was their will. The bill doesn't implement that at all. It's a very lengthy bill, and I think one of the things that your listeners may not know is that the election code has hundreds of sections, and it's quite complicated, as you might imagine, to work out all the details of our elections. And unfortunately, by doing it so quickly, without the opportunity for election officials and citizens to really weigh in on this process, I'm very concerned that we're not getting it right. And instead of following through on the will of the people, we're actually undermining what they voted for in Proposal 3.
Sharon, the proposal language said it would add some of these changes to the Michigan Constitution. Does that mean these bills would need to have three-quarter majorities in both the Senate and House to become law?
No. In fact, there has been a lot of confusion about this issue. So Proposal 3 was a constitutional amendment. Later this month, the language that the voters adopted in Proposal 3 will become a part of our Constitution. And the legislature cannot change those words at all, no matter how many of them vote for it. The only way that the words that the voters put in our Constitution in Proposal 3 can be changed is if a vote is brought back to the voters, if again, the voters are asked to change something. So that is another issue going on right now in the sense that the legislature is not permitted to undermine or curtail any of the rights that the voters of Michigan granted to themselves in Proposal 3.
But that's what his package is trying to do.
So So pieces of the current package in the Senate undermine what the voters have adopted, and that's not permitted. Once constitutional language is enshrined in the Constitution, the legislature cannot undermine it. They cannot curtail it. That is the power and the strength of it being constitutional language as compared to a citizen's initiative.
Tell me, would these bills pass legal muster?
So the constitutional language is the guiding rule here. The legislature cannot undermine or curtail the constitutional language with any legislation. But in order to determine ultimately whether or not that legislation is a violation of the law, it would require us or someone else to go to court and have the bill and the legislation struck down.
What are your concerns with these bills, Sharon?
You know, the concern is really a simple one. The concern is that the voters spoke very clearly. Not as you quoted earlier, it was resoundingly adopted on November 6th, and not just by a large margin of voters, but across the state in 80 of 83 counties, Proposal 3-1. And so the voters really clearly want to have access and security when it comes to their voting in elections. And ensuring the full promise of Proposal 3 requires time, attention, and effort to implement it. And doing something in a lame duck session where it's moving at a very fast rate, where bills are being substituted and changed at the last minute, where election officials who will have to implement that are not really being given a chance to weigh in, and nor are the citizens, that the end result is that it will undermine the will of the people instead of fully embracing Proposal 3.
So the bills were introduced November 29th, and they've already moved out of the Committee on Elections and Government Reform and onto the full Senate?
Well, as of earlier today, the bills have moved out of the Senate committee. So in the course of less than a week, they were introduced. Substitute bills were introduced this morning at the committee hearing without the citizens having any opportunity to thoroughly read through them. And they were voted out of the committee an hour or so ago. And they are headed to the Senate floor all in just a matter of days.
Sharon Delante, ACLU, Michigan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Senator Mike Kowal's office asking for an interview. We have not heard back. Coming up, as the world says goodbye to former President George H.W. Bush today, we talk with his longtime friend, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette.
I think the message for all Americans is George Bush way of service over self.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, so you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
If we have to go to the White House, I'm going as myself.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
What it means is open up your goddamn market the way we opened up ours.
It was on this day in 1843, the U.S. Navy launched a new warship that would be part of the revolution in sailing technology. It would eventually become the target of a Confederate conspiracy during the Civil War. We are talking about the USS Michigan. With us now is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Hey, Rachel.
Hello.
And Joel Stone, senior curator with the Detroit Historical Society's Dawson Great Lakes Museum, which, of course, is on Belle Isle. Joel Stone, welcome.
Hello, Cynthia.
Good to have you both with us. So, Rachel, it's 1843. It has been three decades since the War of 1812. What was behind the decision to build this new ship on the Great Lakes?
In the late 1830s, so there was in 1837 and 38 in that winter, there were a few armed rebellions in Canada. The people of Canada were rebelling against the British crown and lack of political reforms that they wanted. And so during these rebellions, the British Navy sent some ships into the Great Lakes, and these ships were very well armed and very well armored. And the U.S. wanted to compete with those British naval vessels.
So, Joel, what made the USS Michigan stand out from every other ship in the U.S. Navy?
No, it was revolutionary. It was the first all-metal, all-iron ship in the United States Navy. It was kind of a follow-up on an earlier, a smaller vessel that had been developed for the government for surveying, but this was a warship, the first one that they had, and a wonderful innovation by Secretary Upshur. It was by far the fastest ship in the United States Navy, and that's kind of counterintuitive. People think that an iron ship, you know, much heavier than a wood ship, but not the case. It was about half the weight. It was about half the cost. Because of the way it was built, it was much more accurate as a gun platform. It had a smaller crew, less maintenance. It was just a great innovation, although it took the Navy a long time to catch on.
So the Michigan was made of iron. Now, lots of us have been taught that ironclads made their debut in the Civil War nearly 20 years later. Tell us, how did the USS Michigan compare to those famous Civil War ironclads, the Union warship Monitor and the Confederate Merrimack?
Well, ironclad, as the name indicates, is taking a wooden vessel and laying an iron sheath over the side of it, which really takes a heavy vessel and makes it heavier. In the case of the USS Michigan, it was built entirely of iron. Oddly enough, created in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, taken apart, shipped up to Lake Erie and put back together. And it was, because it was all iron, it was just so much lighter and faster that it was an incredible innovation.
And, Jill, do we know if the U.S. Navy specifically chose the Great Lakes for testing out the Michigan?
They did, more specifically, not because the lakes were the best venue for that, but because they could make iron so much cheaper in Pennsylvania than they could on the East Coast, because they had the coal, because they had the iron, because they had the limestone. It was just financially feasible. In fact, the USS Michigan cost half of what a similar vessel at the time being built on the East Coast out of wood. So it was just a wonderful savings. It was a perfect combination of supply and demand.
And meantime, as Rachel mentioned, you had some well-equipped British warships there to kind of curb the Canadian rebellion. Joel, did the USS Michigan see any action through those years?
Well, they did, and mostly the action was pulling other ships off of reefs and off of sandbars. It was an extremely powerful boat. It kind of became a towboat, much to the chagrin of the captain, the Navy captain. But then it got into all kinds of other things. It was involved in the King Strang Beaver Island Rebellion, if you want to call it that, in the 1850s, early 1850s. It was involved in the timber piracy that was going on along Lake Michigan in the mid-1850s. And then the Civil War came along.
And Rachel, so let's fast forward, a few years to the Civil War, and the USS Michigan was beginning to attract some unwanted attention. Who was eyeing the ship, and for what purpose?
As Joel said, the USS Michigan was a far better ship than the ironclads of that era, so the Monitor and the Merrimack, and it had been patrolling the Great Lakes. By the dawn of the Civil War, it was heavily armed, and the Confederate States of America, early in the war, had been thinking about attacking the North through Canada. So in 1863, a plan was hatched to board the Michigan using Canadians sympathetic to the Southern cause and use it against the North in the Great Lakes. Jefferson Davis did not like that idea, so it never came to fruition, and the Michigan remained in the Great Lakes through the duration of the war.
You know, you have to wonder, Joel, if Jefferson Davis had felt a little differently about that plan. When you think of having maybe some Confederate pushing from the Great Lakes and kind of a pincher effect, we might have seen a different outcome to the war?
Well, they certainly would have caused some havoc, that's for sure. And the Michigan during the Civil War also was involved in suppressing draft riots in Milwaukee and Buffalo and Detroit, Chicago. There were also kind of, riots would be the wrong word, strikes up in the copper country and in the iron country that were, trying to get higher wages during a time of crisis, and the Michigan was able to go up and stifle those. So, I mean, if Jeff Davis had gone along with it and the guys had been successful, it would have been a whole different game up here in the Great Lakes.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the USS Michigan, a warship that was made of iron, launched this day in 1843 by the U.S. Navy, revolutionizing warships and warship technology, as we talk with the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and Joel Stone, who's the senior curator with the Detroit Historical Society Dawson Great Lakes Museum. So, Joel, how long was the Michigan seaworthy and serving the Navy?
Well, it actually served the Navy right up through World War I. because of the way it was built. It was overbuilt like anything early on in a technology. It was well overbuilt. So it did very well right through the 1890s. It was at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893 showing off, and then became a survey vessel, you know, kind of working all of the lakes, not in a wartime capacity, but it also served as a training vessel through the Spanish-American War, through World War I, and by the time it got to World War II, it had reached the end of its service life.
So what happened to the USS Michigan when a ship reaches the end of its service life? What's the ending like?
Well, everybody gets real sentimental and they try to save it. And while its name was Michigan, it was based out of Erie, Pennsylvania for its entire career. The folks there tried to raise money and were not able to. In fact, in Detroit, because it had spent so much time here, Henry Ford offered to buy it and work it somehow into his Greenfield Village, and that didn't happen. And eventually the scrappers got it. They were able to save the bow. The first 10 feet of the boat is preserved down in Erie, Pennsylvania at a wonderful maritime museum there. But the rest of the ship ended up at the scrappers yard.
Well, she certainly had a long and illustrious career, I think it's safe to say. We have a big thank you to the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and to Joel Stone, who's senior curator with the Detroit Historical Society's Dawson Great Lakes Museum. Worth a visit on Belle Isle. If you haven't been, do go. As we mark today the 175th anniversary of the launching of the USS Michigan, the first ironclad vessel in the U.S. Navy's fleet. Thank you, both of you, so much. Really interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, he was born in Massachusetts and raised his family in West Texas. But George Herbert Walker Bush was no stranger to Michigan. From training on Grosse Isle as a young Navy pilot to being picked as Ronald Reagan's running mate at the GOP convention in Detroit in July 1980, to campaigning for the White House all around the state, the late president had a chance to make Michigan connections. One close connection that was developed was a friendship with Michigan's Attorney General Bill Schuette, who joined us before leaving for today's funeral in Washington. Welcome, and thank you for taking time to speak with us.
It's great to be with you, Cynthia, and George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and is a special guy and a special American, as is his family. So I'm delighted to have this conversation.
Tell us when and how you first met him.
Oh, it goes back a long time. I had just graduated from college at Georgetown University. I was working as a volunteer. I was Jim Baker's whatever Baker wanted, I did. And at the Ford Committee, and I was invited by Bush's former press secretary when he was a congressman to go to a Sunday afternoon party, brunch at Bush's home in Washington. I think he was CIA director at the time, and it was Burger and Bloody's at Poppy and Bars. Poppy was the nickname that people, his family gave him, Pop. For his children, and Bar is what he always called Barbara Bush. And so we Burgers and Bloodies with Bill Schuette and George Bush, and I met this guy, never met him before. I mean, knew who he was because I followed his career. And that was the first time I met him back in 1976, and we stuck to each other like peanut butter and jelly ever since.
And why do you think that is? What was the root of your friendship? How did that take root and grow?
You know what? What he eventually did is he paid attention to a young guy who was intrigued, meaning me, intrigued by public policy and process and government, and had an opportunity to work with him in his campaign for president in 1979 and 80. And Jim Baker asked me to get engaged in that, and so I did. And I was struck by Bush. He wrote me a personal note, and I've kept every one of those notes and tried to emulate this in this day of, instant communication, texting, Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. The art of taking the time to write a personal note is something I've attempted to do, but it's all because of a guy named George Bush who did it all the time.
And we've been hearing these stories. They're just pouring out from people that say that. Tell us a story that no one would know but you that perfectly sums up just who George Herbert Walker Bush was. What's a special story that sticks with you?
Well, there are a couple. One was was the field representative for George Bush for president in 1979, and I was driving around the state in an orange Camaro, and I was supposed to go pick up Bush in Grand Rapids. I quickly deduced that I can't pick up Bush in a Camaro, so I drove my mother's Jeep, picked him up at the airport, and we drove to Grand Haven, Spring Lake, for an Ottawa County Republican dinner. And we're in the car, and we're driving, doing this and that, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Shooty," because we're talking about him running for president. He goes, "Shooty, nobody said it would be easy, and everybody was right." I thought that was a funny moment. There was another time we're in Florida, in the middle of the state. I was his campaign manager for the state of Florida, and we're driving with, I think I'm driving, and Bush is next to me, and they got people thrown in the back seat, somebody from the New York Times, Bush's national press secretary, and they're driving. And so we're ahead of time, which never happens in politics, right? And I said, "Well, hey," I think I called him George. I had the temerity to call him George. I said, "George, we got to chew up some time here," and because there's a big traveling bus of folks as well. And so we went and had an ice cream cone and just shot the bull at some whippy dip in the middle of Central Florida, and you know, put our feet up. And that was a kind of a nice private moment for Bill Schuette and George Bush.
In his inaugural address, and we've all seen the clips often this week as America mourns President Bush, he called for a kinder, gentler America. And even those who opposed his policies are paying tribute to this president's grace and his humility, exactly as you described. And there's many who feel we've lost that in the America of 2018, that we're divided, we're tribal, and a lot of people feel much of that stems from President Trump. And I'm wondering, what should our president learn from George Herbert Walker Bush?
You know, I think that the more caustic, coarse discussion we have in America today has been evident and prevalent for some time. And part of it's the 24-hour news cycle. Part of it's the instant communication where people you don't even know will attack you on the internet. They wouldn't have the guts to tell you that if you bumped into them at the Meijer store, right? Mm. But I think this happened for a long time, unfortunately, in America because of the day and age of the 21st century. And Bush was born in a different age where you would call people on the phone and work things out instead of an instant email, which frankly usually doesn't really help things. I think the message for all Americans is this George Bush way of service over self. The guy didn't have a mean bone in his body, didn't hold grudges, didn't want to get even. Yes, he understood politics, but he didn't sit around sharpening his knife and say, "Okay, well, I'm going to get you because what you did." And I think that's part of his faith, too. He had faith is forgiveness is a decision, not a feeling, right?
Yeah.
I'm
no,
serious about
that's
that.
True.
And Bush made specific decisions to forgive people and not try to cut their head off. And I think that's really the lesson of George Bush. It's service over self. Don't be bitter. Don't hold grudges. Try to work things through. I mean, it's like when he and I talked about Clinton. You know, when I went to visit him one time, I think Bush enjoyed Clinton because he's and I think amused by Clinton because Clinton, you know, just is such a political animal and different from Bush. Politics was consuming for Bill Clinton. Politics was important to George Bush, but his way of not beating his chest was different than Bill Clinton. So we can all learn from this George Bush example of service over self. Don't hold grudges and be a role model for civility. I think Bush got it.
Well, as you bring up Bill Clinton, and kind of contrasting the letter that President Bush or Herbert Walker Bush left in that Oval Office desk for Mr. Clinton, his rival, it was a bitter campaign. It's hard not to contrast that to the constant barrage of tweets from Donald Trump that doesn't follow the higher angels.
Well, I think that, again, I think this is a lesson for everybody, whether you live in Michigan or whether you live in 49 other states and the four territories. The fact of how George Bush conducted himself. And it was a competitive campaign, right? Bush worked very hard, George Herbert Walker Bush, to win that election in 92. And I think that the loss was really hard for him and his family. But what did he do? He understood that the service and his responsibilities as president were more important than his personal feelings or the contest of politics. That the office of the presidency, duty to country, service over how he might be feeling, that was more important than George Bush being upset about losing the presidency. And that's why I wrote that letter. I think that's pretty special.
Absolutely. It's very special knowing that your friendship started at Burgers and Bloody's with Poppy and Barr in 1976. And you know what? While we have you, what is next for you? You've had such a long, long run in public service. What are you thinking of next?
You know, I have no idea, Cynthia. There never was a plan B because I'm wired to win and I'm wired to run through the tape. And obviously, the outcome wasn't as I wished. And I had a terrific team and so grateful for the people with whom I worked on a daily basis and folks across the state. And what an honor it was to be the Republican nominee for governor. What's next? Well, you know, I got to wind up the campaign and help my great team with, you know, employment opportunities. So I'm going to do that, make sure we have a proper professional transition with the next attorney general and do that in the proper professional way. And then in January, you know, I don't know what plan B is. Maybe get into broadcasting. Maybe work with you, Cynthia.
There you go. Well, meantime, we want to thank you for sharing your memories. We know you will be at President Bush's funeral, and we want to thank you so much. Special memories from Michigan's Attorney General Bill Schuette. Thank you very, very much.
You bet. Enjoyed it.
Stay with us. We talk about medical marijuana in Grand Rapids next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the city of Grand Rapids gave a green light to medical marijuana businesses this summer, the explosion of interest was immediate. It was major, so much so the city decided to hit the pause button for a bit on accepting applications for medical marijuana licenses. With us now, Suzanne Schulz, the Director of Design, Development, and Community Engagement for the city of Grand Rapids. Suzanne, take us back to July. The city passes this ordinance saying, okay, we're allowing medical marijuana businesses in Grand Rapids. How much interest? How many inquiries came your way?
We have had huge interest. Within the first 3 days after the City Commission passed the ordinance, we had 200 calls, counter questions, and emails directed towards staff about it. So it was a little nuts.
That was passed in July, and you could say the first day you get 200 calls, and I'm guessing you were getting regular inquiries as the days went on.
We average 15 to 30 calls a day between emails, calls. So it has not subsided. We have a website that we've created that is regularly updated. So hopefully we're trying to cut down on the number of calls and questions we get. But it has sustained. That has not really loosened up at all.
This feels a little like maybe the 2018 marijuana edition of the 1849 California Gold Rush, a little bit.
It certainly does. The real estate prices that we're seeing are 2 to 3 times greater than what they were before marijuana was approved. People are really speculating all over the place. So it is very much like the gold rush if you compare it to speculations. But it has been nuts. The amount of interest, especially from both local people who have been involved in the state, and then people from outside of the state, who every place from Las Vegas to Denver, to California, who have expressed an interest in being in Michigan, and in particularly in Grand Rapids, that being the second largest city in Michigan, we've certainly attracted some attention.
Are you making it a priority to you want to really kind of get local folks in the door first?
For the City Commission, this has been a priority to get local involvement in the industry, both on, I would say on two fronts. One is persons of color and trying to ensure that people who have been traditionally marginalized by marijuana policy can somehow benefit in some way from the industry now being normalized or accepted among both the state's residents as well as the city residents. The other avenue is really trying to build our local economy, and people identify us as Beer City and other monikers, but really this sense of entrepreneurism amongst people who have been in Grand Rapids and really really grown, whether it's Founders Brewing Company or other similar cases where we start out small and then grow, and it really benefits our community in multiples of ways. And so the City Commission really tried to design a program by developing a City Commission policy that would tailor local preference. And so that is something that we've been highly focused on.
And on Tuesday, the commission took some actions and started trying to organize, basically when license applications will be taken. So what happened Tuesday? Break it down for us.
So on Tuesday, the commission approved two City Commission policies as well as zoning ordinance text amendments. They took the ordinance that was approved on July 24th and adopted some amendments to it. As we got more questions from the industry and started to actually work with the ordinance and administering it, we realized that there were some changes that should be made to make the ordinance better, more clear, consistent, and easier to administer and enforce. So we had those recommendations for them to adopt, which they did. And then the two policies, one was a parks waiver policy to waive separation distance requirements around public parks pending certain conditions. And so the policy really set forward what those standards for a waiver would be. And then the third one was a MyVita, we call it, the Marijuana Industry Voluntary Equitable Development Agreement. And the Voluntary Equitable Development Agreement is really aimed at that local piece that I talked about, that they're looking for local preference. They're trying to get investment within the city by residents of the city. And they're also trying to encourage local hiring as much as possible. So those were really priorities that they had set. What that policy will allow us to do then is set priority for applicants who will be heard by the Planning Commission for their special land use request. So as they come in for their facility applications, it will tell us kind of how to order them based on how many of those goals an applicant is able to achieve.
And I know that January 22nd is the date that the Planning Department will start taking in land use applications for the safety compliance facilities and the transporters. And then March 4th will be the beginning of applications for medical marijuana growers, processors, and provisioning centers. What does all of this mean for the future of recreational marijuana in Grand Rapids, Suzanne?
So recreational still needs to be discussed by the City Commission. They have been heavily focused on medical marijuana and wanted to get that resolved. It certainly does set a template, though, for future discussions about recreational. And we expect that probably this summer we'll start those conversations with the Commission.
Suzanne, through this whole process, what has surprised you the most?
I think what has surprised me the most is that partly the industry, we have been able to develop a very good working relationship with the marijuana industry, which I may not have fully anticipated, in the way that this has really become a good collaboration with everyone trying to help us develop the best ordinance possible so that we really can be very thoughtful and effective in how we do this. We are not allowing unlimited number of facilities. We are limiting the number to about 40, which is being regulated through separation distances. And those in the industry who are very serious about it and who want to see it succeed have encouraged us to start small and not open the doors wide and open ourselves up to a whole range of issues. So I think that part has been interesting. So too has been the partnership we've been able to create with other cities who have been kind of going through the same thing. It's almost a group therapy, it's sharing those experiences and what to expect. And certainly there's a whole range of lessons to be learned from that.
Suzanne Schultz with the City of Grand Rapids as we talk about the green rush for the medical marijuana future in Grand Rapids. Suzanne, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's been tough for scientists to convince the public that climate change is real and it is a threat. Yet that was the blunt message of the fourth National Climate Assessment released late last month by the federal government. Scientists from 13 federal agencies warned of the growing dangers we face from climate change. To Andrew Hoffman from the University of Michigan, this latest report makes an important economic case. He is the Holcim Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the Ross School of Business and the School of Environment and Sustainability. Now, you say, Andy, the latest National Climate Assessment, coupled with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the IPCC report that came out in October, are both part of a shift in discourse happening right now around climate change. What is this shift?
Well, one of the problems with climate change is trying to get people to see it as something relevant to them. And so we typically talk about three forms of ways that people disconnect themselves from it. It's going to happen to somebody else, it's going to happen someplace else, and it's going to happen far into the future. Therefore, it doesn't become personally salient. But a lot of the conversation recently and reports coming out saying, no, the effects are happening now, and they're going to get worse in the near term. And they have dollar signs connected to them, and that's key for making it salient.
So that psychological distancing starts to erode when you start talking dollar signs and what it can mean to your pocketbook.
And to you. I mean, this isn't going to be people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh anymore. It's going to be people who live in states, and we know them, and they're friends of ours. There are survey data to show that the number of people who believe that climate change is real is creeping up. And most notably, Republicans. It's above the 50% mark and continuing to grow. And when you ask, why are you changing your position, the answer is always the same. It's because of the strange weather we're having.
And you recently wrote a piece in The Conversation titled, Rising Insurance Costs May Convince Americans That Climate Change Risks Are Real. So to that point and what you're leading us into, what does it take? What more will it take to make climate change real for people who don't have that scientific background?
Well, they need to hear it from somebody that they trust. And certainly the insurance sector can be seen as an honest broker, might you say, someone who doesn't have a dog in the fight other than looking at the data, looking at the statistics, looking at the payouts and saying, this is costing us more, so we're going to have to adjust our coverage and we're going to have to adjust our premiums. And that will get people's attention. The number of natural disasters has tripled since 1990. This isn't science data. This is data from Munich Re, a reinsurance company in Switzerland. And the number of natural catastrophes, natural disasters, 1990, just over 200. Last year, well over 600. Last year in the United States, the highest amount of insurance payouts, $330 billion. This costs money, and someone has to pay for it. And that will make people sit up and notice. That's just talking about insurance payouts, but damage from natural catastrophes, like Hurricane Sandy, for example, 50% of the damage was uninsured. So that cost is borne by the individual homeowner and the taxpayer.
What did you take away from the latest National Climate Assessment for the Midwest's economic future?
Well, they talked about particular sectors that are going to get hit particularly hard. And agriculture is one of them. And, you know, whenever I talk to people who make the money off the land, I always ask them the same question. I say, do you see climate change? I'll get one of two answers. It's never no. It's either, are you kidding me? Of course I see it. Or, I'm not ready to say climate change. That's that liberal stuff. But something weird is going on, and I've never seen this before. So anyone who is connected to the land, and that's certainly agriculture, mm-hmm. sees it happening. You know, I remember talking to a coffee grower in Costa Rica, and he was like, look, I'm growing varietals I never grew before. I can't grow the ones I used to grow. I'm seeing pests I never saw before. I'm irrigating fields I never irrigated before. This is what we're dealing with. And so those are the people on the front line. And certainly agriculture and tourism is a second sector.
Talking
and,
Michigan.
You're talking Michigan. And, you know, this state is all about water. It's part of our identity. If there becomes problems with access, certainly as temperatures rise, algae blooms happen. Who wants to go to the beach in a state that has algae blooms? That will affect tourism dollars, agriculture. I remember a number of years ago, I remember that cold snap we had, the warm snap we had in January, followed by a very cold snap, and the cherry crop got decimated.
They had to import cherries from Europe for the cherry festival.
Yeah, I remember when Cherry Republic had the Polish flag out front thing for
that's
the cherries.
It. That's it.
And then you can look at just the shift in certain plant species. Scientists are anticipating a day where you will not be able to find buckeyes in Ohio.
You know, this week the UN Secretary General declared the world is, and this was his quote, way off course in its plan to prevent catastrophic damage from climate change. Is it too late? What kind of transformation of the world economy do we need?
You know, there's a really interesting question there of whether do you really try and scare the bejesus out of people to get them to move, or does it just sort of demotivate them and get them out? I struggle. You know, the IPCC report and the National Climate Assessment do a lot of projections out to 2100. Now, a lot can happen between now and 2100. So you can look at the science and say, if nothing changes, this is where we're going. But people can change. Societies can change, and they can change rather quickly when properly motivated. I like to think of 9/11. Our conceptions of freedom and privacy changed overnight. So what kind of an event, what kind of a stimulus could society have to get it to suddenly take this issue very, very seriously? There could be some major technological advance that could get us to say, you know, think about the old promise of nuclear power, energy too cheap to meter. That could get people to buy into it. A major catastrophe, or significantly, there was a study that came out in Nature Climate Change in November, making the point that by 2100, again, this magic date 2100, which again for people is still too far off.
It's very far.
You and I will not
be
here.
I was saying that to the gang here. Well, I'm gone.
but our children or grandchildren will. So it's their future. But they came out and said what we will deal with in 2100 is not just simply natural catastrophes, but compounded, that you'll have multiple ones. And I do remember a very vivid conversation with some folks at Swiss Re. And if you're not familiar, reinsurance companies insure insurance companies. So they're looking long term. And they said if we had three or four Hurricane Sandys or Hurricane Katrinas in 1 year, you'd find a tight constriction of the insurance market. You can't drive a car. You can't build a house. You can't sign contracts without insurance. Insurance makes the economy go. An example, if you remember the Bhopal disaster in India.
Remind everybody what that was.
Well, so you had a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India. And they had accidental release of methyl isocyanate. Thousands of people died.
Yeah.
And Union Carbide almost went down for this. There was an arrest warrant for the CEO. If he set foot in India, he was going to be arrested. Insurance companies saw this and thought, holy smokes, we have no idea what we're doing on pollution insurance. Pollution insurance backed up. You couldn't get it. It reemerged 4 years later at 11 to 15 times the price with much less coverage. When insurance companies do that, business practice changes. You know, are we going to self-insure? Or if we want to get the insurance company, we have to change certain practices.
It's a formidable prod.
Right. So if insurance companies start to move forward in restricting coverage, and there are glimpses of it here and there. State Farm pulled out of the state of Florida because they're regulated. They need permission from the government to raise their rates, and they wanted to raise the rates for coastal properties, and the state said, you can't. They said, then we can't cover it, and we're out of here. There was an interesting event. I'm blanking on the insurance company, but there was an insurance company that tried to withhold coverage to some municipalities west of Chicago for natural catastrophe disasters by saying you should have been anticipating climate change because your big neighbor to the east, a.k.a. Chicago, has been doing it. Now, the case got thrown out, but it was a sort of an opening salvo of insurance companies start to adjust their thinking and their coverage on insurance. And it's not just natural catastrophe payouts. It's business interruption insurance. If your company goes down, there's insurance for that. There's also directors and offices insurance. If you've got a CEO who says climate change is not a problem, and then all of a sudden they get whacked with some liabilities, shareholders have a right to sue that CEO. There's coverage for that.
Okay.
And if climate change becomes an issue in there, and that brings up a very interesting point. Shell has just announced that they're going to link CEO pay to carbon reductions.
And I've heard that talked about. I think that's been in the works. Yes.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting development of just different aspects of the economy, because this is an economic issue.
But speaking of the CEO, let's talk about America's CEO. So this climate change warning is put out by the federal government, and the man in the Oval Office says he doesn't believe it, shrugs it off. What are we supposed to do with that? I mean, how do we rally to meet this challenge when our president rejects it and doubles down on coal?
Well, I mean, first of all, they had to release the report. It's required by law.
Yeah.
They did release it on Black Friday. It didn't seem to squelch it. The president can come out and says he doesn't believe it. But, you know, this is interesting because there are many within the corporate sector who are moving anyway. You know, our example of Shell, and there are many other companies are saying this is our future. Either A, for economic and market and strategy reasons, we're going to move towards this, whether you're in electric cars or alternative drivetrains or renewable energy or battery storage, the markets of the future, we're moving anyway. I mean, I'm sorry, but if the administration doesn't want to acknowledge it, we acknowledge the market shift. But beyond that, many see it, you know, in agriculture, you know, Cargill, ADM, General Mills, they see this as part of their future and they're adapting to it whether, you know, Trump acknowledges it or not. I like to think of the line that Galileo, when he was silenced by the Catholic Church, he's purported to have said, and still it turns. So people can say climate change is not happening, and your response can be, and still it changes.
Andrew Hoffman, University of Michigan Ross School of Business and the School of Environment and Sustainability. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Cynthia.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.